This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. When it comes to socializing, is your battery bursting with energy or feeling drained? Do you thrive around people or do you need more alone time? It can be easy to spread yourself thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, strengthen your self-confidence, and much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/heartwisdom today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/heartwisdom.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Jack Kornfield Heart Wisdom Hour. We are delighted to share with you Jack's innate common sense and his clear, open heart. In order to continue presenting these podcasts, we need your support. Please go to mindpodnetwork.com/jack and you can donate there, or you can go through our Amazon or Audible affiliate links. And that's another great way to support the podcast. Thank you for your generous attention.
This is great. Jack Kornfield and Pete Holmes making fun of my voice.
Well, is it really your voice, Duncan?
That's right. Who are we? Are we this voice? Are we this weird body that we stick, you know, avocados and hamburgers in? Is that, are you a hamburger and avocado or something more?
Yeah, that thing. That's something that I was reading in one of your books that really, you know, the thing where you're sort of reading about a Buddhism or religion and then it kind of like
sneaks up on you
and then you can't go back. And that was the thing in one of, I don't remember which book it was, but it was find where you are in your body. Where you were talking about, fine, where are you in your body? And I'd never really thought about that at all. And then I was stoned then thinking about that. And so that was a really big moment that I haven't come back from, which is, where am I in my body?
Yeah. No, what is your shape, too? I don't remember when somebody introduced me to that thought, but I think I was in college when they were like, where does your kind of feeling of yourself end? You know what I mean? I always feel like I'm in the upper part of my body.
So there's a passage where Alice Walker writes, she says, one day when I was sitting there like a motherless child, it came to me that feeling of being a part of everything. And I knew if I cut a tree, my arm would bleed. And I laugh and I cried and I run all around the house. In fact, when it happens, you can't miss it.
Yeah.
And so one of the weird things about being a human being is that we have this capacity of shifting or changing identity. And so you're the identity of your work, or you're the identity of your, you know, culture or your particular class, you know, or the identity of your politics. I'm a Democrat or a Libertarian, Republican, or you're identified with your body or your emotions. But then you have these moments where you're making love or you're walking in the mountains or you're listening to an amazing piece of music or like that Alice Walker thing. And so I said, wait a second, I'm not just my body.
Those peak moments. I was just listening. I'm on a pretty big Deepak Chopra kick. And he was talking about that.
He stole it from me.
He stole it from you. That's weird.
No, he didn't.
No, that. But
we all stole. We're all actually thieves of all the previous generation's spiritual comedy.
So. Well, I'm glad that it's not constantly changing. It would be nice that you guys all have similar ideas. But that idea that when he had those same similar examples of making love or looking in the eyes of a lover or looking at a view or something that really you don't need to be told that it's happening. It's like falling in love, I suppose. And you just believe that it's real.
Yeah,
yeah, man. Into yeah. it.
Well, what is real?
I don't know.
That's a good answer. I like that answer.
That's the only answer, probably.
Yeah, no, you know, there's a Zen master I studied with, a Korean Zen master, Daesan Senim, and he used to say, he would ask you things like, what's real, or what's consciousness, or what is love? And I don't know. He'd say, good. You keep don't know mind, only I don't know, don't know. He said, this is a very good mind. It's really innocent mind, beginner's mind.
Right.
What is it?
Well, don't we get in our own way the more learning in a certain sense that we do? I mean, isn't there a certain childishness that's encouraged to getting to
And there's that famous Zen story of the governor of Kyoto going to see the Zen master and saying, I have a bunch of questions. And Zen master says, I'm sorry, I'm too busy. And looking at him and says, your cup is too full.
Hmm.
And so the guy pours the tea out of the cup, walks out the door, comes back in and says, you know, I'd like to introduce myself, does it all over again, not as the governor of Yokota. Hi, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is so-and-so, and I'm just learning. And the Zen master says, oh, yes, come sit down. We have a nice conversation.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I've heard a similar Zen story where the guy, with tea, mm-hmm. and he comes to the guy, and he wants to learn, and he pours him a cup of tea, and he talks about how, like, he's been all over, he studied with all the masters and accumulated all this knowledge. And that, yeah, you've heard it. And then he pours the tea, and he keeps overflowing it. And he's like, what are you doing? You're spilling the tea. And he's like, you can't put more tea in a cup that's that full. You know who said that? Yeah. Seinfeld. Big
really?
Zen guy.
No way.
Yeah, I heard that from, not in person, but I heard him say that in an interview. But the D.P. Chopes thing that came to mind when you were saying that was, we were talking about death, and he was like, what are you talking, like, what you are you talking about? You were talking about being an avocado or a libertarian. And we were talking about the idea that, like, college Pete, or easier, baby Pete, is already dead. You know what I mean? That we're constantly fading away, and everything is a dream. I find a lot of delight in those sorts of things. Even that conversation I had with him is already a dream. Even when I met you, Jack, is already a dream.
That's right.
That forces me into the moment.
It goes back into the void with the pharaohs and the dinosaurs and things. 2000, remember the year Y2K and all that stuff that was going?
Yeah.
It's gone. It's a dream. Yes, 2013 is a dream.
Right.
And things come trooping out of the void, and we have this moment that's absolutely magic, and then it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
This reminds me of what happened to me at this VR studio that I went to, which you should go to.
What's a VR studio?
It's a virtual reality holodeck.
That's your thing now.
Got the most advanced VR tech.
Really?
Right now, yeah. And it really is, it is astounding how realistic it is. But what happens after you take the goggles off, after you've been in this virtual reality for about 20 minutes, you take the goggles off, and your mind gets this kind of digital jet lag because it can't understand how suddenly you are in the Ukraine. It's some kind of weird shooting range, and now you're back in Culver City in a tech lab, and you're disoriented. But I can only compare it to jet lag. And the guys who are working on this stuff, they said, it feels like you're waking from a dream, doesn't it? And it is exactly like that. The mind just can't accept that reality has shifted instantly from one place to the next.
What's interesting is I think the foundation for a lot of my own spiritual curiosity is an active dreaming life. And I think that sort of disillusionment with this reality comes from the fact that I'm snapped out of a very, even more realistic than this reality, dream life. So I'm in a dream, and I know I'm dreaming often, and I'm like, that wall looks like it's stacked with books. I can see the names of the books, and I can see the colors in the grain of the wood and all that stuff. And then it's over. You wake up. Sometimes you're snapped out of it. So just like taking the reality goggles off.
Right.
And then putting them back on every time you sleep. And also I think that informs how we view death. Every night we die, and we have dreams, and we go this other place, and then every morning we're resurrected.
So does that translate for you in not being afraid of dying?
Well, that's a big fear for me, I suppose, unfortunately. When the, you know, I think of that Indiana Jones wall that was going down, and you got to grab your hat before it closes. A lot of the stuff that was swept into my subconscious before I was old enough to kind of put boundaries up there was a lot of you are evil, you're bad, your boner is evil, you want to fuck girls and that's evil. You want to say things like fuck girls and that is evil, and you need to be purged and cleansed and God doesn't like you the way you are. So when I'm on a bumpy air, like right now, I can tell you, or when I'm meditating, I can tell you that I'm ready to slip away, and that's fine, and I don't fear that. But if I'm on an airplane, you know, and it gets bumpy, I start feeling feelings like I don't want to go because I'm afraid that I'm going to go to sleep or die and have a bad dream, that I'm going to be judged somehow, that I'm going to be punished somehow.
Well, and it turns out that that judgment is really one's own self-judgment. You know, and if you look in the Ars Moriendi and all the kind of spiritual texts from the Egyptian Book of the Dead and the Middle Ages Books of the Dead and the, you know, various other and so forth, that there's judgment that's depicted. But it turns out from people that have, whether it's near-death experiences or remember, somehow seem to remember having died, past lives and so forth, the judgment isn't somebody's going to come and judge you. It's really what's been in the way you judge yourself. And we judge ourselves so much. I mean, they wouldn't hire you to be a judge in a civilized country, most of us. We're so hard on ourselves. And then, well, we think, because you're, like you're talking about, you get brought up and there's something wrong, original sin, or something originally wrong with you, and you better keep judging yourself or you're just going to turn into this person who rapes and pillages and so forth. That's who you really are.
Right.
And that's nonsense. In Buddhist psychology, the opposite ground begins by saying to you, O nobly born, you are the sons and daughters of the Buddhas. Remember your own pure, true nature. This is a dream. This is a dream created by mind and consciousness and form. And you can make beautiful things with it. This is what's given to you to play with and to work with. And you have a fundamental nobility and dignity and capacity to do that. And that's a really different message.
I think that speaks to my urgency to want to experience God. I don't like the one that was just told to me through anecdotes. And the more I hear things like that and trust my own instincts and things that resonate with me, the more peace I do feel. That makes perfect sense. When you want to tell me that I'm a part of God, that I'm God manifesting in this form, and that music stand is God manifesting in that form, I guess we would call this pantheism, wouldn't we, Duncan?
I don't know.
Which is a type of blasphemy, as I was raised. That feels good to me, that all of this feels like a type of
Well, the beautiful thing is that it's not philosophy. That it's really the description of, we could call it mystical experience, but it's just deep human experience. We, as we talked about, we know it when you sit with somebody at the side of the bed when somebody's dying, or you sit there with someone who's giving birth, since we're three guys sitting here, we get to witness it, but we don't do it. The gates between the worlds open and you realize, wow, this is a whole mysterious thing to be incarnate in human being. Spirit comes into the body, it leaves the body. That must be true for me. What we are is consciousness. What we are is awareness itself. Wow, look at that. And then all of a sudden, it's not that old-time religion, but it's the direct mystical experience of the galaxies and you're being part of them.
That's very interesting. I'm very interested in it. And this is one of the things Duncan and I talked about when we first kind of had our first kind of mystical discussion, was taking the Christ message away from judgment and fear and sort of like organized religion, all that sort of thing. We had the Christ consciousness, which is one of the first things you kind of taught me about, Duncan, and his call, I think, to enlightenment. And then we had that turned into something that was more like, don't fuck your neighbor's wife.
Right. Which he never said, as far as I'm aware. That preceded him. And
a lot of that stuff is in the Old Testament. Most of what creates a kind of fundamentalism in Christianity is really the old tribal dictums of the Old Testament.
Right.
It wasn't what apparently, who knows what he actually did, but apparently the records don't have him going around saying that kind of stuff.
No, but there is this, there are, you know, he was, the thing that he was talking about was a very radical radical change in the way people are living. And if you apply what he's saying to your life now, then you're going to have the most very radical shift in your life. In the same way in Buddhism, when there's this story when they ask the Buddha, what are you? And he's, are you a god? I don't know, remember exactly how it goes, but he says, I woke up.
I'm awake.
And when you consider that, it implies that what he's saying is, I'm awake when a great many people are asleep. And it's what you were talking about, waking from a dream or taking off the VR goggles.
Right.
It's that radical a shift. When he says, I'm awake, he's not saying, well, you'll be more lucid if you start meditating. It's saying, this is the difference between being asleep and awake. It's that radical a shift. Both of these teachers are pointing in the direction of this thing that is...
Well, Christ talking about the kingdom of God and the kingdom of heaven and all that sort of stuff coming to you now and being here now. Yeah, that we changed. A lot of people took the kingdom of heaven as heaven being something that happens after we die. And I do think Christ was talking about something that was here and now and easily accessible, being an enlightened being that could kind of see the truth, I suppose, as opposed to this lie that we keep.
I find using the word enlightenment to be problematic in our culture. It came through the Victorian translations of Buddhist and Hindu things and so forth. I like what you're saying, Duncan, of using the word awake rather than enlightenment, because people have all these ideas about enlightenment, and you think I've got to go to the Himalayas and sit in a cave or find some enlightened master someplace or other. And it's actually where you are. It's awakening. It's not enlightening, but it's actually dropping away of that separate small sense of self and sensing that you're part of this great mystery.
Right.
One of my colleagues and dear friends, Trudy Goodman, who runs the in Santa Monica Insight Meditation Center there, talked about before she ever studied Buddhist practice, she was... left alone in labor for some circumstance in this hospital a long time ago, and there wasn't anybody with her, and it was scary and painful and all the confusion of being 20 years old or whatever it was and giving birth and being all by yourself. And then she said something took over, and she described how her body felt like it wasn't her body, it was all the mothers who had ever given birth to children, and that she was part of something that contractions come by themselves, just like our breath comes by itself. And we're being breathed. We're not breathing. We're being breathed by the earth. And she was giving birth because she was life giving birth to itself. And she said, then I realized afterward I need to find a spiritual practice to help me to understand and keep this wisdom, this understanding alive in me. So we have it. It's part of every child, and they're a child of the spirit, of their innocence. And then, it's enculturated out of us, or we lose it and we get caught in the body of fear, which is that separate sense of self. And it's fine to have fear, and it's fine to feel separate sometimes too. It's just not the whole story.
I am interested in the how we reconcile being awake and also being successful when you see this lie that we're all kind of participating in this society, and that people, I think fundamentally, when you do become wealthy, let's just say monetarily wealthy and self-sustaining, it often comes down to a couple somewhat selfish decisions, or at least the ambition to envision things being better for you than necessarily everybody. Which is, I think, kind of tricky.
So you're asking the question about how does spirituality fit together with creating material wealth for yourself in some way? And here's Gandhi, who said, my best thing is to own almost nothing, a tin cup and a spinning wheel that I make my cloth, and, so I can't be bought or sold. No one owns me. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But can you own a big house and, have investments and so forth
Yes.
Pure?
If you look at all of, it's not just someone like Deepak who is obviously doing well, or Eckhart Tolle. These are best-selling authors. You know what I mean? Where in the...
Buddha's a bestseller, and so is Jesus, by the way, that they're just not getting their royalties on the, on the physical plane. They may be getting karmic royalties, but anyway.
I guess it goes back to that thing of, like, Duncan, you told me this thing I always think of, is that when someone does wake up, that waking other people up is like being in a plane crash in the Arctic, and you swim out and everybody's probably dead and you sit on the ice and you dry off for a second. And then the teacher is the guy that dives back in, thinking that maybe somebody else, even though it's unlikely, might be able to unbuckle them and get them
up
to you.
That's a pretty dire description of
yeah,
the state.
That was Duncan.
I mean, it's kind of cool, but it's a little bit dire. I do think we help each other wake up. I think that, just as you said, you have lucid dreams and you realize that when you're dreaming, that also that it's a dream. And there's a whole Buddhist practice of dream yoga in which you awaken in your dreams, and you also watch yourself shift from dream state to the regular waking dream state. Mm. And you start to realize all is created from consciousness and mind. Yeah. But I don't think it's that as dire. I think people can wake up in a moment. You can remind them. And it's a really beautiful thing. And, you know, sometimes it happens collectively. And then we fall back asleep at different times. You know, I use that funny quote from Annie Lamott, the last podcast I was talking about, where she says, "My mind is like a bad neighborhood. I try not to go there alone," you know. And so people are sometimes afraid of silence or vastness or mystery because nobody taught them that it's okay. In fact, I read a sociological study that said that the majority of Americans have had mystical experiences and most of them wouldn't want one again. And the reason is, I think, because there's no context for it. Well, what do I do with that? You know, I'm supposed to get a job and get a paycheck and do this. And then how do I handle that? And it wasn't there in church. Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, said that primarily modern organized religion serves as an inoculation against mystery. It's like, okay, it sort of covers that base and then you don't really have to look deeply.
Right.
But when it happens and you go, oh, wow. I'm not who I thought I was. I'm spirit. I'm soul. The world is illuminated by consciousness. It's not that far away, really. And if you have good friends or you have a community or you have some support in some way, you realize, oh, I could live differently. I could remember this.
Hmm.
And you do. You know, and remember it and forget it, of course.
Yes, but but again, you know, I don't think we covered the question of what about wealth? What about if you find yourself in some kind of opulent, wealthy life? If you look at Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, the prince surrounded, he had a harem.
He did.
He had a
you
harem.
You say that with some enthusiasm, though.
Yeah.
No, I do.
Yeah,
I mean, how
exactly.
Great would that be? He had a harem, and he was loaded and had everything, and look what he did. He wandered off into the forest and became an ascetic. And in the same way, if you find yourself with a ton of money and you find yourself in this situation of having investments, as you said, then you're also in this place. I've been reading Zizek. Have you gotten into Slav? Oh, man. Zizek's amazing, but there's a book I'm reading called Violence that he wrote, and he's exploring what is violence? What is it, really? And he talks about how to have wealth in this society, it requires a healthy level of denial. In the same way to eat a steak, if you really want to enjoy it, you can't think about where this steak came from. I was actually at a steakhouse in Vegas with sad pictures of cows on the wall. I don't know why they did it. And out of the speakers at some point, I swear I thought I heard like animals screaming, like they were piping it in. And so what Zizek is saying is like this wealth to be truly wealthy in a world where so many people are starving, where right now there's a refugee crisis. We have the largest refugee crisis in the world, the largest groups of people being displaced since World War II, that to be wealthy and to be in this situation is innately violent in the sense that you have to ignore the suffering around you if you're going to have tons of dough. So... Well, how do you wake up in the midst of having all this? Isn't there something to be said for what Gandhi did? Just drop it, man. Let it go. Just drop it.
I think it would be both idealistic, overly idealistic, and oppressive to say that that's how people have to live.
Mm.
we have all these possibilities, and to come in as a human being, you have this mysterious palette of possibilities, and some have gifts to be artists, and some will be successful, and they'll get a bunch of money being artists. Some have an economic gift. I have a friend who's amazingly good with numbers and can remember, and he happens to be a gifted financial person. He's not exploitive at all. He owns property and helps other people, but it's just he had that gift. And he likes doing it and so forth. We have all these kinds of gifts. And you say, okay, well, the only thing a human being should be is to give away as much as they can because other people are hungry and so forth. And we should all live baseline really, really simply. That would be a kind of dull world, I think. I think there is something, Dalai Lama says, Mittelbach is his language for it. I think that there's a possibility of having a relationship with money that's wise, in which you use it both to care for yourself and your family or your business, but also you use it to care for the earth and to serve. There's a relationship to wealth that's full of greed and hatred and exploitation, makes you unhappy and makes the world a worse place. There's a relationship, just because the Buddha left the dancing into the palace and so forth, doesn't mean we shouldn't have music and dancing. I would be really sad for a world without music and dancing. There are monks and nuns who've chosen to live really simply, and I did that. The monastery was beautiful to live that silent life without all of that. Absolutely, and you really learn a lot, and you can live in this exquisite, vast, beautiful, open place. It's not always that way. Sometimes you don't like the monk in the hut next to you, and you get in conflict with him. Monasteries are not all that peaceful, you know, but you can. But I don't want to take spirituality, and it would be another oppression, like you talked about, you know, Pete, of your childhood religion giving you a sense of sin or something, to say money is bad or commerce is bad or you know, some other creative arts are bad. They're not. They can be done in ways that are wise and playful and joyful. And joy, you know, the fact that someone else is suffering, it doesn't mean you have to be despondent all the time. That's not helping that person in that village or in that refugee camp. Mm. I see the Dalai Lama, and people go to hear him laugh as much as anything. And I think they do because they realize that he carries the weight of all the tragedy of Tibet, but that it's not the end of the story, that his spirit is still free anyway, and that he can be joyful and laugh. And you know, as he said, they've taken so much, they've, you know, burned our temples and stolen holy books and taken our opportunity to keep our culture alive in these different ways. Why should I let them take my happiness? That there's a certain way in which our spirit is free, and then we can play in this world and do beautiful things with it. And depends what palette you pick. How's that?
Love That's it. Good. You know what's weird?
So you can make a little money on your podcast, just not too much, and you have to give half of it away to refugees. And
sorry.
I'm going to be auditing your tax returns to make sure you've done your part.
But there, something that I don't think people talk about is the fact that there is sometimes money and luxury. Let's just say having more than you need, not necessarily living paycheck to paycheck, does enable you to actually have less concern. So I don't think about, I don't consider myself wealthy, but I don't think about money as much as I did when I was broke.
You just have other concerns. And it's true. If you don't have food, shelter, and financial security, you worry about that all the time. And this is a very serious and real comment about our human. But then the happiness studies show that if you have a decent level of money, which is, I forget what standard they put for a family, it was $75,000 a year, which is above our national average a little bit, then you stop thinking about money, and then people don't get happier between $75,000 and, you know, $7.5 billion or something.
Wow.
That part doesn't affect you. Yes, you're not worried then. You know that your rent will be paid, that your kids will have clothes, that the things that matter to you are covered. And after that, happiness is not really affected very much by how much more money you have.
Right. I will say, and I don't really like talking about this stuff, but I have a business manager that pays my bills, and then I have an assistant that dropped my laundry off today. You know what I mean? So, like, what did I do today? I meditated. You know what I mean? Because I didn't have to pay my bills or do my laundry.
So is it a bad thing, or are you giving your assistant a job?
I'm saying it's a good thing.
He's got a job.
Right.
You get to meditate part of the time and also do the creative work that you do, that kind of kooky creative work that takes meditative time. And your assistant has a job and would probably be very grateful for that job.
So does my business manager.
If you treat them well.
I agree. I just don't hear too many people talking about the truth. When I hear that Richard Gere is a Buddhist, I'm like, yeah, I'm sure you have a dope sand sculpture room that's painted a clay gray and it's incense and it's probably transcendent and wonderful. You know what I mean? I do think that that's something that I don't hear too many people discussing.
Oh, yeah. You're saying sort of like, okay, well, like, here's Richard Gere, the eminent Buddhist who's got some kind of, like, probably has, like, somewhere in his house an envelope filled with, like, the Buddha's hair or something. and here he – and he's, like, he's got access to – he could – I bet Richard Gere has the – I bet he can text the Dalai Lama. I bet Richard Gere can –
I bet he can.
I can send emoticons to the Dalai Lama.
Right, sure.
That's right.
So
it's always just those
sad
hands praying.
Right, or one of those little ones with your hands together.
Yeah, he can send the hand emoticon to the Dalai Lama.
And then the Dalai Lama sends back one with his hands together and a little smiley one saying, it's
yeah,
okay.
That's right.
And so does, yeah.
No, please.
So is that a good deal that you have access to the Dalai Lama?
But here's
like
really,
well, is
he's,
it fair?
It's like he's saying this is like doping in sports. It's like, it's not fair in baseball. If somebody starts blasting with testosterone, they have an unfair advantage over the rest of us.
Or you're just the Yankees and you have the money to buy the best players. I'm saying I'm a pretty spiritual person as long as every single one of my needs is being met.
Oh.
That's really what I'm saying.
That's part of our task. The thing is that they won't always be met, for example. And I say that when people come and meditate and they go through hard stuff, you know, and their body is hurting and they say, why can't I move and just make it easier? I say, you can move. You don't have to make it hard. But once in a while, it's actually all right to actually useful to sit when your body's hurting or when you feel like you're going to die of loneliness or guilt or grief or all this stuff that you don't usually let yourself look at. Because sometime in your life, you're going to be in a hospital either sitting at the bedside of somebody who's dying or going through this stuff, or you're going to be going through it. And if you don't know how to handle that part as well, you're up the creek, really. Hmm. If you want to take the curriculum and have the 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows of a human incarnation and do something beautiful with it, you actually need to somehow be able to bear it and stand it and open that window of the mind and heart. And then you have some choices. Without it, then you become frightened. I don't have enough money. But if you realize, okay, I can live simply. If I lose the money, I have other ways to do that. Then you're not living in that body of fear that restrains you. So yeah, of course it's nice to have things easier. We want that as human beings. It won't always be that way. It's guaranteed there's going to be some moment where it's not what you want. And then how do you live? You'll have plenty of opportunity to practice with it, which is why it's actually helpful to have some inner training or some inner learning of how to be present for the whole catastrophe.
You know, I have a question for you, Jack. I think part of my problem is I take things personally. So when I have some sort of spiritual achievement, I'm like, oh, I'm cool. I'm like a good meditator.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always want other meditators, people. It's very interesting to me that you're saying that you've done the monk thing or you know, lived in a meditative society sort of thing. I want to hear the superhero stories. I want you to tell me that you've left your body and, you know,
I came back, right. And then there it was in the same old guy. That's the problem. Leaving wasn't the hard part. It was coming back. It's like waking from the dream is, oh, let's see, now I have to brush my teeth. Now I have to pee. Now I have to go deal with my relationship. Now I have to talk to my business manager, which I don't have, but I should very well have.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
A good idea.
It's nice to not have to worry about your rent.
But yeah. I mean, in that way, I did this book a while ago that the title was After the Ecstasy, the Laundry, in which the point of it in some way was to say that there is no enlightened retirement. People think, okay, I'm going to get to this great state. Everything's open. My heart's open. My mind is so peaceful. It's open. And now I got it and I can hold it and I can just keep it. And you can't hold on to anything. And even the Buddha and Jesus, because you were bringing them up and so forth, they had backaches and physical problems the Buddha did, and then he had all these monks that were misbehaving and they wouldn't listen to him. And he said, listen, I'm the Buddha. And they said, yeah, yeah, but we're... And they were so... he was so frustrated with them in some way. They were so recalcitrant that finally he just threw his hands up and said, I'm going to go and live in the woods with the animals. They're a lot easier to live with than you monks. And spent a year kind of away, you know, removing himself from all these people that were fighting. And we don't have to ask what happened to Jesus.
Right.
But even before that, when Buddha and Jesus went home, they had trouble with their families. Just in case anybody listening is having those troubles, there's a long lineage of this. So this is called human incarnation in some way. And how do we live in a way that we take this mystery of being a human being, we don't forget the mystery, we don't get lost in the sort of everydayness so much that we've forgotten it, and then we make it a work of art. You know, but it's not going to be always open. It's going to be up and down and hot and cold and praise and blame and gain and loss and fame and disrepute. That's the way
he looked at you.
It's
for disrepute,
woven.
And he looked at me for
well,
fame.
You don't like the disrepute part. You like
Duncan's
the fame
disrepute.
Part. He gets
no,
the disrepute.
I'm the fame. You're the disrepute.
No, not go. According to how he looked.
That's how. That's, and so what are you going to do with it? This is what incarnation is woven with, right? And you can say, all right, I'm going to try and only have pleasure and no pain, and I'm going to have gain and no loss, and I'm going to have birth and no death. I don't know what planet you think you're on, you know. So, and as a culture, we try, you know, our security devices, and we try to make everything really secure. Helen Keller said at one point, security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do children on the whole experience it. She knew what she was talking about. Hmm. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. And she says that in some way really as an invitation to us, because this is the life that we've been born into. And if we take the small self, we get frightened. But if we realize we're part of something so much bigger, so magnificent, the life force that's in you brought you to birth and has kept you breathing and your heart's pumping, your liver's working and all these, you get 100 billion new blood cells a day, you know, reborn in your body and you don't even have to do anything, you know, it's all happening. And you get to be the artist with it. And that's a beautiful thing. So spiritual life for me is not either about some great enlightened state or something that you fix and now I've got it, enlightened retirement. It's more like surfing, you know. Waves are up, surf's up. Yeah, far out. Let's go out and ride the waves.
And then they go away.
They go away. They sometimes. Get flat, you know, and so forth. Okay, this isn't a great surfing day. Or you take a really bad spill, you know, and that's all right.
Hmm.
But it's not self-improvement. It's really much more about mystery and love and consciousness itself. Can we awaken and see the beauty in the eyes of the people around us and the lavender color in the puddles at sunset and taste, you know, what is it like to eat a kiwi? We didn't have kiwis when I was growing up. They didn't ship those things from wherever they grew them. Now they grow them, I'm sure, in California. I remember going to Asia and... having my first taste of mangosteen or rambutan or these fruits that you don't get here or durian. And you know what it's like to eat a new fruit? You're like a kid again. Look at the color of this and wow, this whole other taste. And no one can tell you what an apple tastes like. They can say it's sweet, it's fruity. No one can tell you until you taste it. And then you go, wow. And every day is like that. Every day is saying, hey, here's a new fruit, every new moment of a new day that nobody in the entire galaxy has ever experienced before. And you get to bring beginner's mind to the table if you want, somehow.
I want a durian.
I think I have
durian ice cream. It's very good
stuff.
I bet
it's good.
Yeah.
But you know,
smells
the others...
bad, but it tastes great. That's like life, right?
Durian, that's what I heard. It smells bad. You know, The thing about what you're saying is where my mind will go the next time I'm eating a fruit is, you better enjoy this fruit, man. And then just the very act of trying to enjoy it, I won't enjoy it. It's, you know, the effort, like what you're saying. Here we are, this insane pulsation of cells and atoms that are perfectly harmonized to create a form that somehow we manage to believe is us. This, it's all effortless. But the moment you apply the slightest effort to these things, it's all gone. It runs away. It's like, you know, going in the woods and making loud noises while you're trying to hunt. It just runs. So I might think, oh, I'm going to really enjoy this. This is it. I'm going to eat this durian fruit like I'm Deepak Chopra. But it's just...
That's funny. I'm the opposite. I actually find, like, when I'm meditating, I love my mantra. But at the same time, I find it just as helpful to go be right here while I'm doing it, just reminding myself what I'm doing. And if I say I'm going to
eat... Well, you're clearly more spiritual than Duncan.
Well, no. I'm interested in why it's the
opposite. No, he's saying something actually very important. Mm. And what you're describing, Duncan, is what your mind is doing. It's a thought stream. So there you are with the mango or the mangosteen in your hand, and then your mind has a little bit of spiritual advice for you. You should be here fully enjoying this. And then another part says, shut the fuck up. You know, I don't want to hear you telling me what to do. I just want to enjoy this. And another part says, see, you're just arguing with yourself. And, you know, and all that, basically, that's a stream of thoughts. And so you can say, oh, that's the mind. Thank you for your opinion. Mm-hmm. Right. And then you say, now let me hold this mangosteen. What is it like when I open it in my fingers? And it's not that you have to get rid of that or think, oh, I shouldn't have that. Part of really one of the best things about meditation is that you learn not to believe your mind. And so it does those things. That's what minds do. They secrete thoughts, and some of them are cool thoughts and some of them are stupid thoughts. You know, it's like that cartoon of the car from the New Yorker, of this car driving across the Utah vast, wide desert, and the roadside billboard says, your own tedious thoughts next 200 miles, right? It just does. It prompts a thought, and you can believe it, and then you say, I'm a jerk, or I'm magnificent, I'm a fabulous person, or I'm a horrible person, so it has all those stories about you.
You pointed to him when he said fabulous, and me when you said horrible.
We both noticed that.
I thought I pointed the other way.
I certainly wasn't trying to, you know that.
I know, of course.
That wasn't even in my mind.
But, you know, so to know, I mean, one of the simplest exercises I do and I teach people is to have them count their thoughts for 60 seconds. And they'll count, you know, 6 thoughts or 12 thoughts or 13 thoughts or something like that, picture and word thoughts. The beautiful thing about it is that they realize that the thoughts are thinking themselves. You know, and that it's possible to become the witnessing of the thoughts and notice, oh, there's a healthy thought, there's a unhealthy thought, there's one that's kind of destructive, doesn't have a lot of my good interest at heart. That's a conditioned thought of that kind of. And so you don't have to believe your thoughts. And that's tremendously helpful and liberating.
Totally. That's all I had.
Me too.
Totally.
Totally, he says. Totally. And we stop with that.
Tell me but about then, you leaving your body.
He wants to hear about the mystical stuff.
Yeah, I want to hear trippy
what
stuff.
What do you want to hear?
I want to hear about the first time. Could you?
So I'm there.
But Jack,
I am.
Before you go,
yeah, right.
Just know that I've been told many of these stories, and I'm not a skeptical person. Duncan, you know that. I'm never convinced. I just don't think the story is told. I've had people tell stories of losing their car keys that have more wonder in them.
That sounds very good to me. I mean, car keys are, it's amazing because, you know, car keys, now your car actually waits for you and it opens itself. I mean, that's, if you were like some shaman coming out of Africa or the Amazon or Siberia or something, and you'd watch somebody walk up to their car and it would light up and say, dude, this guy's got some real chops as a shaman. Yes. So I'm all right with you on the car keys. They're very cool.
I don't mean to put a burden on you to tell like a charismatic story. I just want to believe
just
so bad.
Just one story.
Please.
Just
please.
Believe. Yeah. Well, nobody can help anybody believe. You have to find your own thing, of course. But I will tell you this. So there I am, and this is just a common thing. I'm meditating away. I'm in this monastery in my early years as a monk.
How long had you been meditating?
Well, I was on a year-long silent retreat. And so that's a long-ass retreat.
Wow.
I know that's true.
That's not a retreat. That was just...
That's right. That's like a prison sentence or something. Anyway, somebody said, yeah, I'm locked in a phone booth with a lunatic, basically. It was this little hut, right? But anyway, and the instructions were to sit and for an hour and then walk for an hour and sit for an hour, kind of alternately being mindful of what was happening. And I got very tired because they said try to, this particular teacher I was with said try to cut back on your sleep. So the afternoon I'm like sitting there and very sleepy and tired. And I say, all right, I'm going to let myself lie down and sleep, but only for 15 or 20 minutes because I'm supposed to be doing this meditation stuff and thinking that I'm going to get enlightened, which was, you know, I was young and naive. And that's how you thought about things at that time. And so I lay down, and 15 minutes passed, and I lay down on a hard wooden floor. I thought, well, I won't sleep too long that way. I woke up, and I started to do my walking meditation. There was a little, like, veranda at the, on the outside of this hut. And I walked out, and I walked on the veranda, and then I looked over, and I could see in the distance my teacher and some other people at the other end of the campus and so forth. I walked back, turned around, and as I walked back into my hut, I was shocked. There was this person sleeping there. Hmm. I said, oh, how's that? That's really weird. And then I walked closer. I said, oh, it's me. How did that happen? I was so intent on getting up. My body was exhausted, just didn't want to get up. But I said, I'm going to get up. And I did. And I oh, my gosh, this is what they call an out-of-the-body experience. How cool. So I walked back outside, and I looked around. I walked back in.
Oh,
and then I came very close, and I kind of peered down at my body. And then I felt myself tumble back into my body. And then my eyes opened. I thought, oh, here I am, lying on the floor.
Wow.
So you asked for a first story.
And it's beautiful.
Now, it's not that uncommon. People in a car accident report floating above their body. People in surgery, you know, it's a relatively common thing for people when their lives are in danger in certain ways to leave their body and float out and feel that consciousness isn't limited by their body. So it's a relatively common thing. But the beautiful thing was that this wasn't an emergency. And then I realized, oh, you can train yourself to do this.
And have you?
I've repeated it. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you at a point where you feel like you could do it if you wanted to?
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever... Now, I do believe you, for what that's worth. I'm not saying that should mean anything to you. I think that's a lovely story. And this, I'm not usually burdened too much by this. I'm okay with paradox, and I'm okay with things that are transrational beyond our reason.
I mean, that's just a tiny story, but you asked for a beginning.
I would love some more.
Anyway, keep going.
My question for you is, have you ever wanted to put a playing card on your desk and not know what that card is and then try and leave your body and see if you could look at it and then have some sort of objective data?
Yeah. Yeah, at certain times.
How'd that go?
But this is a really interesting, and it's kind of a little bit paradoxical. When those kind of gates open up, then the kind of clinging materialist thing, it sort of goes away. It's not all that interesting. It's like the sense of wow, amazement, wonder is so much more juicy than whatever's on the playing card. And I had a teacher who, it was said, had all these kind of psychic powers. And Joseph Goldstein, my colleague, and I, and Sharon Salzberg, at one point we said, well, would you show us to this woman? Mm-hmm. And she said, no. And so I'm sorry, I wanted to watch her walk through a wall or materialize. I've never seen that. I'd love to have seen it.
Right.
But there was some way, I think, in her response, which she was communicating, you know, that's really a dead end. It's really a side thing. Yes, okay, here's Uri Geller, and he can bend a spoon with his mind, and they get all the people in the lab, and he's still bending a spoon, and some scientist is saying, well, maybe he's kind of secretly blowing air over there, and it suits him. They can't figure out why or how it's happening, but it does happen, you know.
That happened? There were scientists that watched a man bend a spoon?
Yes. Yeah.
But I don't know. I ran into these when I did that show with Rogan. We got to, you know, there's activist skeptics who are.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. And I like those guys. They're
I do,
good too.
They're cool.
But that's because spirituality isn't about, I mean, if you want something amazing, just walk out on the damn street and look around. Everything's amazing. Is, you know, Walt Whitman said, a mouse is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels. The fact that life exists, that, you know,
right,
that little mouse crawls around the corner, and that it has the same nervous system that you do, more or less, with eyes and ears and responds to the world. Where did that come from? Where did all these, there are a million species of beetles on the earth. Oh, well, evolution, Darwin says, that's a nice thing to say, but what's making all this display of life?
Because right. Here's the thing, you know, if let's say suddenly some mystical child demonstrated in front of
that they could levitate. There we are. I'm the White House. I'm going to show the White House press corps levitation.
Yes.
Here I am. I'm floating, and
yes,
everyone goes, okay, it really is mystical, right? And how does he do that? And also, can we weaponize it?
Right.
That would be the next question.
That would be the next question. And then after they figure out how the levitation happens, mm-hmm, within 2 months, no one cares. The levitating child is old news. So it's really what you're seeking is novelty. You're seeking the experience of wonder that happens when you realize you're in a bigger universe than you thought you were.
If we could prove that, this is my interest. It goes back to a fear of death, actually. If we could prove that you're leaving your body,
mm-hmm,
and that it's not just an imagination of your mind,
mm-hmm,
and it's not just you constructing a very vivid dream, then I would go, oh, Jack isn't Jack. Jack is a spirit, just as we've always surmised, as we've always believed. And if I left my body, I know Christ said a faithless generation asks for a sign. I feel that way all the time. I'm like, yeah, you nailed me, Jesus. But the idea of getting out of my body and seeing my body and going, oh, this is me and there's that, and I'm seeing this and I'm experiencing this, means that when that thing dies, who cares?
But maybe the thing that pops out of your body dies too.
Yeah, I guess.
That's a problem. Maybe that thing dies too. You know, you get out of this shell. Maybe the thing that gets out of the shell is also impermanent. And if that thing has another thing that pops out of its shell, maybe that thing dies too. It's just this, you know, infinite change. It's like even coming out of your body doesn't mean that everything isn't going to stop or end, or the universe isn't going to hit some zero state. You know, there's no escape from death. Even if there's an escape from physical death, you know, I imagine no matter what, we're all going to face some oblivion. Isn't that the idea? Isn't that the idea that it's, or that it already is oblivion?
Well, these are in some ways also metaphysical questions, you know, which both existence and time are all created together with consciousness. And does it mean that consciousness is eternal? Is it always going to be here? Is the universe created out of consciousness? I think so, but we'll have to wait and see. These kind of questions, they're very compelling in a certain way in our minds. They were not actually very much of interest to the Buddha. He said, I'm not actually interested in having you get a new set of beliefs. All that stuff came later about past and future lives and stuff. That was part of the common belief of India, and he worked with it. But he said, I'm not interested in giving you a new set of beliefs. I'm more interested in your looking at the circumstances of human life, which you have. For whatever reason, you got in there as Duncan and Pete and Jack and whatever. Here we are. And you can do this in a way that creates pain and suffering for yourself and others, that creates more entanglement and more loss and more difficulty, in which case it's a bad or an unhealthy or an unfortunate way to use it. Or you can take this very same human life and, understanding the laws that govern it, see what brings joy, what brings ease, what brings graciousness and care to yourself and others. And in it, there will come to you a sense of freedom, right where you are, not in the next life, not in by some belief, but in the very day that you're living with the very people that you are, you can actually be free. You can be free to love. You can be free to create. You can be free to serve someone else. You can be free to care for yourself because they're not really separate in some way. And this is possible for you. And that, he said, I only teach this. I only teach what's practical for human beings to discover, to awaken and discover that they that there's a freedom that is your birthright. And the rest, he said, you know, metaphysics was not really of much interest to him.
I mean, I'd love to fly to the moon is all I'm saying.
You sure. Get bored of the moon.
Well, and then Thomas Merton, the Christian mystic, says, of what avail is it to fly to the moon if we can't cross the abyss that separates us from ourselves, if we can't really know who we are? We can go outwardly places, and you all have. I'm sure you've traveled to wildly cool places, as I have in great things, but there's this other journey of really awakening to who you are, to this mystery of consciousness, of awareness itself. What Ram Dass calls loving awareness. Look at you, say, you are loving awareness. You are this awareness itself. You are love itself. I don't think so. Well, that's a thought. Maybe you are loving awareness. Maybe that was what was born in you, spirit.
One more body story.
Yeah, please. And I want one little levitation. It doesn't have to be very far. Just a couple inches would be enough.
No, just because they're cool.
Well, you know that story Terrence McKenna says? It's a story about a guy who went and meditated in the woods until he could walk across water. He meditated in the woods. Have you ever heard that story, Jack?
I don't know. Tell me.
He meditated in the woods for years and years and years until he gained the ability to walk across water. And he went back to his master and said, look what I've done. And he shows him. He walks across water. And his master says, the ferry costs a nickel. He didn't need to go in the woods for years and years. What are you doing?
That's right. That's it.
Still, cool story.
Yeah.
But see, Pete wants to watch him walk across water just one time.
I just...
And then, you know, and then you say you won't be afraid of death. But I think you will anyway. I mean, because I notice in myself, we do have these openings to mystery and that thing that Alice Walker wrote about. We have our own experiences of oneness and of emptiness and of nothingness and of dream and coming back and so forth. And part of us feels like we're connected with eternity, and another part is afraid. And that's part of being human. I think that's part of having a body. The body, I came back from the monastery after I'd been there for some years, and I started to drive again. And I was driving down the freeway, and the truck in front of me blew a tire, and one of the big parts of the tire came off, and the other cars were swerving and almost crashing because there was this big pieces of black rubber, you know, on the highway kind of smashing into one car and things like that. And I thought, I was just a few cars back, that we were all going to crash and I was going to die. My mind was very calm because I'd been doing all this meditation, so peaceful, equanimity, just, oh, wow, maybe this is going to be it. Maybe I'll die. My body grabbed the steering wheel, wrenched it over. All this adrenaline came in. I want to live. I got to steer myself through it. And it's almost like there are different parts of us. Mm. One part that says, oh, sure, eternity. Yeah, another says, not yet, baby. We're sure. And so you get to see all of that. And spiritual life isn't somehow to get from one to the other, but to realize that it's all here, that it's who we are, actually, and that we are both timeless beings, and you want to remember that. Without that, your life somehow gets lost down the rabbit hole of everything being very materialistic and so forth. But at the same time, in remembering it, you also then come back and tend your garden and how you drive and how you talk to people and what seeds you plant of beauty on this earth. Through your art or through your work or your business or something, they need to be respected equally much. So you have a foot in eternity and a foot in the human world. And that's the way you move.
Nice.
Awesome.
Call this episode Not Yet, Baby.
Not Yet, Baby. That's right. That's right.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Jack Kornfield Heart Wisdom Hour. We appreciate your support, and we ask you to continue that support by going to mindpodnetwork.com/Jack. Look forward to seeing you next week.